Welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast. I'm John Corrid, your host, and I'm interested in sense-making in relation to how culture shapes how we think, behave, and see the world in our everyday lives, at work, and in the social groups we belong to. So why is having the ability to look in our everyday lives important when trying to understand how we behave and make sense of the world around us? In this first episode of Series 4, I'm going to explore how looking and observing provides us with rich cultural narratives that interweave into each other to produce tapestries of human behavior. To unpack the benefit and power of looking, I discuss with my guest Christian Masbier his new book called Look, How to Pay Attention in a Distracted World. For the past 15 years, Christian has lived in New York. He is an author, entrepreneur, and academic who works on the practical and commercial application of the human sciences. He is the co-founder of the global consulting firm Red Associates, where he advised executive teams in some of the largest companies in the world on strategy questions based on empirical and organized observations of the human world. And Christian is also professor at the New School in New York, which is part of Parsons. Now, what I love about Christian's book is that he explores different ways of looking and seeing, from art, philosophy, and anthropology. A core point he makes is once you are able to look at yourself, you can start looking at the world around you. We talk about watching people playing chess in Union Square in New York City and discuss how observing chess players in a public space, for example, helps one to understand key human questions such as what is winning and how does winning fit into a cultural framework. Christian says practicing looking is so important to seeing around you and learning about human phenomena, so it should almost be like going to the gym. And I do this when I'm on a bus in London. I'll be observing people as an anthropologist or on other public spaces, creating hypotheses and potential stories before moving on to another destination. So as an anthropologist, these types of conversations and thinking really do provide rich and fertile soil to develop interesting ideas around how culture frames who we are, from ritualized, conscious and unconscious performances. Before we hear more from Christian, I want to remind you that I have two new training courses starting this year. The details are in the show notes, along with a link to my executive and team coaching. And also, if you find these podcasts interesting and helpful, please do feel free to leave a small donation towards the cost of bringing each episode and series together. It would be greatly valued. The donate link is in the also in the show notes. Now, over to Christian. Well, welcome, Christian, to the Decoding Culture podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm sitting here in South London in my home studio where many people are. It's getting dark. It's 4 p.m., but we've had a lovely autumnal sunny day, which has kind of broken up the rain, the sideways rain that London offers at this time of the year. Where am I talking to you?
I am in my country house just north of New York City. It's like an hour away from New York City. Across the border to Connecticut. And New England in the fall, like right now, is just on fire. The colors are so gorgeous. Everybody should try one time in the year to come to New England for the fall.
Oh, wonderful. I've been there once to New England, but not in the fall. It was summertime. You're spending most of your time, though, in Manhattan, is that right?
Yes, exactly. That's where I live.
And how long have you been there? Because Copenhagen, or not Copenhagen, but Denmark was home. That's where you originally formed.
It was, yeah. I've lived there for 15 years now.
Okay.
So I moved, 2008, in the week where Lehman Brothers went down.
Wow.
So where Manhattan was just decimated by the financial crisis. So it was probably the only person moving to New York that week, but it was great.
It's kind of seeing through the lines. I mean, there are times when we have to do that. I think I was doing a startup my own consultancy in the same year and people said you were mad. So maybe you just have to do it, you know. But listen, we're talking about your book, which is Look, How to Pay Attention in a Distracted World. I said this to you before we started recording. It's really is beyond engaging. I like this idea of how to pay attention in a distracted world. And you could kind of go, in a distracted world, oh my God, which we are living in at the moment, because there's so much we could unpack what's going on. Why did you write it?
Well, first, when you've written one book, then you end up in a machine that just forces you to produce another one. And then when you've done that, the machine gets even stronger. So there's a kind of a momentum that means that I just have to write something. But it wasn't, that wasn't the main reason. The reason was that I wanted to write a book about how I found my way to the type of observation I think is helpful and that I like to do. So I didn't study anthropology like many great observers did. I studied philosophy, but I somehow on my own found a way to a perspective on how humans operate and how to observe human beings and groups of human beings. And I came to that through fine arts and literature and philosophy and also anthropology, of course. But it's a, sort of a, my own winding road. And then I made a class based on that and kind of asked the students to read and look at the things that inspired me. And that class, for some reason, really helped the students and became sort of a, you know, a thing on campus where I taught. And then I thought, like, maybe I should make that into a book. So it's really the class that came through 20 years of study for me.
Yeah, but it is packed with, we'll go into some of it in a moment, but it is packed with, as you said, it's not just your kind of lineal anthropological thinking, which it's not lineal, right? I mean, as an anthropologist, I shouldn't say that. But the use of art, and it's just, it's got that wonderful depth with broadness about how different disciplines we, you know, you can all observe. But one of the things I was going to think about, well, how does looking and observing, and I guess listening, help us to understand the world around us?
Right. Well, first of all, it's joyous to, instead of concluding anything, just waiting and looking at what on earth is going on. That there's something just delightful about it. The second is that I was interested in actually what is looking in the first place? What is attention in the first place? How does the perceptual apparatus, our ears and eyes and sense of smell and so on, how does that really work from a sort of at the deepest level, at the most sort of ground level? How are we humans experiencing anything at all?
Yeah.
And then say, based on that, so when if you can see how you are seeing yourself, then you can also see how other people are seeing. You can sort of get to a stance where you observe people of how they're seeing the world based on your own understanding of how you are. So it's a way to connect with what's going on
mm-hmm.
In the world, really. And it's an extraordinarily helpful in all walks of life.
You talk about hyper-reflection. And I loved. I think there were three stages, but I'm not going to say what hyperreflection is. It's your words, your thinking. So just give us a frame of what this means.
Yeah, it's actually Maurice Merleau-Ponty, the French philosopher, that coins the term. It's not me, but it's if you think about three ways of paying attention. The first way is you could call it focus, that you focus in, hone in on something in particular, and you study it. And you study it where everything else disappears, right? So science can do that, can study a particular color or a particular sound and so on. And that is a helpful thing that we all want more of. And it's what we say, tell our children, you know, pay attention means locking away everything else. Then there is a kind of the second type you could call more panoptic kind of attention, which is what we usually humans usually do, which is not paying attention to anything in particular, but much broader. Pay attention to everything and nothing at the same time. So if you walk down the street, just on 13th Street where I live, I'm not paying attention to anything in particular when I walk down to the schools of my kids. I'm not focusing on anything. I'm not honing in on anything. I see all of it at once, and I know how that works. I know what schools are. I know what traffic is. I know what bakeries are. I know the dynamics of the street, which means I don't have to pay attention in the sense of focus. It's also what great sports people do. If you see a great footballer run down a field, they're not, if you look at their eyes, they're not paying attention to anything in particular. Nothing is really going on in their head in terms of sort of cognitive processing, but they know exactly what they're doing, and it's a beautiful thing. Mm. So that's sort of panoptic attention. And then there's hyperreflection, which is looking at how other people are looking. So when you walk down the street, you can get into this kind of mood or observational mode where what you're looking at is, how does this all this work? Like, how are these people, these bodies moving through the street, the driving of cars, the soundscapes, and so on? You can get into a mode of observation or a mode of attention where what you're paying attention to is how other people are operating in that field. And that is the core of ethnography when it's done well. But it's something humans can do and that we should do more of. I think you can train yourself in it. I think you have to go to a kind of gym every day to be able to do it well. But it's basically understanding how a social context works without having opinions about it, without judging it, just looking at it and figuring out how on earth is this, you know, happening. And when you do that, whatever, you're just going outside the door of your house becomes this sort of weird, magical thing that, you know, that you can study and be surprised by and enjoy, even though it's the same door you go out of every day.
I love this idea, what you just said, about how you can leave your front house and it could be magical. I mean, it's poetic, but actually it's a very powerful statement, because it's thinking about or appreciating the everyday and what's happening, not in a kind of well-being sense, although it could be, but just that pushing you, the gym, the observational gym. One thing I do with sometimes with kind of execs, before I do any training with them, they have to turn up, but they must have gone on a walk that they do every day. So that could be taking your kids to school or maybe going to a coffee cafe that they will go to. It's a routine, not a ritual type of thing. You know, they don't see it. But I will say to them that they have to observe two things they've never seen before on an everyday journey. And what I get in response before they do it is a sense of fear, which is quite interesting. It's challenging almost safety through a routine to look and see differently. So it really hits me that, actually. Well, one of the things you do, you talk, and I know in your previous work as well, the philosophical kind of theory and framework of phenomenology, and you mentioned Merleau-Ponty, as really important to understanding how we observe and why we observe. But can you tell me a bit, why is it important? Why was it important for you to really frame a lot of the book around that?
It's just where I come from. It's my entrance into to the world of observation, I suppose. It's not through the door of anthropology, it's through the door of philosophy. So I studied Merleau-Ponty and Martin Heidegger and so on, and I've taught it quite a lot. And it's just the way I've been thinking about it. And the reason why I like it is it's so basic. Like it's discussing deep, deep things in the most basic way. So I know you play jazz, but if you know, an A on a piano is what, 440 hertz, I think, right? It's a particular frequency that, you know, if you have the ear for it, you can hear that's an A. But that note, so that note hits your eardrum with that particular frequency, and you can study that, and that's focused attention, you could say. But if an A is part of a chord or chord progression that belongs in a particular type of jazz, we don't hear 440 hertz. Mm-hmm. We hear the whole context of jazz at once. Mm-hmm. And we know what world we're in. We understand it. It has history. It has deep, deep roots. And so the frequency can be interpreted in that way. But if it belongs to a different chord progression, suddenly the same sound sounds like pop music from the 60s or something like that. So, and sometimes it can be in between styles and we get confused for a second, but really it is the same frequency. So it could be color. Like if you see a particular Pantone strip of a red color, and that's of course a scientific experience. I mean, it's scientifically measurable in terms of the light, and it hits your retina, and you know, it is processed into an experience. But if you see the same color on a fire truck or on a woolen sweater, it's exactly the same scientific experience. But one is quite fire trucky and has danger, or you know, has particular references to it. If it's on a woolen sweater, exact same color that hits your retina, it has a woolly autumn-like experience to it, right? So the idea that we never experience meaningless atomistic data points. We always experience things as wholes or as gestalts. Okay. And that's the core idea in Merleau-Ponty's philosophy, or you know, in Heidegger as well, is that our experience of the world is fundamentally different than a machine, or than a camera, or a microphone. We experience not A equals 440. We experience jazz with everything that's involved with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of the philosophical ground under how humans experience anything at all, really.
And there's a wonderful example. Maybe you could. I could have read it about how we perceive a train depending on its distance. Can you say a bit about that? Because I have been standing on platforms in London now trying to decode the different ways I perceive a train.
Right. Yeah. I try to come up with examples that are so obvious and so simple that you can experience or you can play with it yourself. But so if you stand on a train station and you see a dot far, far away, you know it's a train, but you see basically a small dot. And then if you were a camera, you would see that dot increase in size in even increments as it got closer to you, right? But if you try to experiment with that, that's not how you see it. You see a small dot, and then suddenly a train arrives. So it moves from the gestalt of being a tiny dot in the far away or yonder to very close and the gestalt of a train that involves everything we know about trains. So it's not an even ramp of increments. It's either small or big train. You can see that in modern art as well. There's a great artist called James Turrell who makes these buildings with cutouts in the roof, and anybody should try to go there. There are many of them around. I think if you live in London, there are many of them.
Okay. Yeah,
they're called sky spaces, and you can sit inside of them and look up towards the sky. And the experience he's trying to create, he says his goal is to get people to see themselves seeing, and it's the same as the train. It's as if you sit up, you look up, and it's as if the sky has been pulled down to become the ceiling of the room you're in, and it is kind of so close by and feels like the ceiling, but then a plane or a bird flies by, and suddenly that it's no longer the ceiling. It snaps back to become the sky, which is far away. And then the bird goes back and snap back to become the ceiling again. So humans operate in these holes, or these gestalts is what Merleau-Ponty calls it, from the gestalt therapy movement. But that says something about human perception, human experience in terms of seeing at the most ground level, really.
I'm going to carry on with that because there's a very important thing I want to you've raised. Although I do have to carry on with the train, I'm sorry, because I have been practicing the train thing. I noticed also in my experiences of the train as a dot to the train stop stationary at the station or the platform, but the emotional impact as well. So a dot, it's there, and it potentially means I'm going to be on time. So I've got a different type of persona to self. To when it stops and the doors open, there's a sense of maybe anxiety, safety. Do I get a seat? Can I be productive? Can I not be productive? So it's quite incredible where the function is getting a train from A to B. I'm actually experiencing all these different emotions, which can be positive, negotiation, fear, all these things. So that's I don't know if that's another area of that, but it's certainly something that I experienced.
Yeah, because the train being close to you and you have to get in is a world. And that world involves working in the train, getting on it, making sure you get off it, the other passengers, the seats, and so on. That's a whole world. And we experience the world as worlds. Mm-hmm. So the world of trains. You could also say you walk into a room and there's a chair, and the chair has a particular color. And if you focus in on it, you can see what color it has, and you can think about the materials and so on. And you can think about the historic use of chairs and all kinds of things. But mostly you just see chairs, but because chairs are connected to tables that are connected to dinner plates that are connected to roast chicken, right? And that are roast to and a particular kind of conversation style, you could say, around a dinner. And we see all that at once.
Yeah.
We don't see the chair and then another chair and the color of it and the shape and the distance between them. We don't see that. We see dinner. And that can be evolved that's of course an emotional thing as well.
That's a really good point. And reminded me of just that kind of endless getting lost or walking around an IKEA showroom.
Right.
Those little rooms where you there is that chair that you might have visited IKEA to buy, but actually what you're confronted with is lifestyle.
Right.
Either you wish that you had, or you could have, or you do have, you know, so that's a ready. So now, Christian, as a, you know, I work as a consultant, so I have to rely on things. And one of the things I do rely on, which I think by and large is very helpful, is LinkedIn. I use it as a means of keeping up to date with stuff, making some comments or making some noise for the algorithm to play around with, if we're going to be honest. What I've noticed, though, and I'm not saying this is anything new, but it's this idea of here are five tips to deal with conflict at work, or here are five tips to create psychological safety, or here are five tips, and everything's very much, it's consumable. Now, I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. However, you made the point in the book that we're kind of, as humans, we're living in a world where there's, as you call it, a simplistic framework. And I have put this with my own experience in the world of business. So where sense of everything is made simple to a certain extent. So you use the terms fast and slow, but in a sense, it doesn't allow us to engage with the complexities. And Marie Ponty, I think you mentioned, causes the cop-out. So I guess being devil's advocate, what's wrong with simplicity?
Nothing. I mean, simplicity is helpful, worth striving for, particularly when you write on LinkedIn, if you want anyone to read you. I just like exploring phenomena a little more. You know, you could say, for instance, I play chess, and I play chess sometimes at Union Square, which is down the street from where I live. And there are these people, some of them are excellent chess players. They don't have ratings because they don't play in organized ways, but they are excellent. I sometimes go down there, play against them, but sometimes I also just go down to study them. And the reason why I'm not studying them as people, I'm studying, for instance, I like to study the concept of winning. Like, what does it mean to win?
Okay, yeah.
And you could say, what's the cop-out? Well, winning is better than losing. You know, the simple five ways to win in chess, something like that. But if you look at what's going on there, where people come through, they try to win against these people, they are lured in by the people that are working there as chess, you know, as chess players. And it's not necessarily about winning in that way. Mm. Sometimes it's to teach your son to play. Sometimes it's to pass the time. Sometimes it is winning in a particular way, winning in a particular style. So you could say the simplicity of winning can be described in 5 points on LinkedIn. But if you study it and study what winning really means, it's a whole lot more and a whole lot a much richer world to live in. If you see that winning is in chess on Union Square is not just about not losing. It's about a whole range of practices that are going on there. And I think that's important if you want to win, even like if you want to win in so many other aspects of life, to understand what does winning really mean to me, and what does it mean to other people? And it's quite a lot more than not losing, I think.
It reminds me of the young, absolute years ago, I did an ethnographic study on skateboard culture. Now, Christian, I'm 6'5", and there's no way I'm going to get anywhere near a skateboard. But that was quite good. I went with fresh eyes, knew nothing about the culture of a competition where you have the half pike or the vert. And the guy who was winning, so I think they had 30, 45-second slots to see what, and he was doing fantastic jumps, and all the other competitors were applauding him. And it got to the end, but they were all egging him to carry on. So he would have won, but they didn't care about the rules anymore. It was their enjoyment. So it was a completely reframing of egalitarian and just enjoy the craft, the art of doing the competition.
Yeah. I mean, you can also say the deep mind won against the best Go player in the world in, 2016 or 2017, around that time. And you could say it won in the sense that it locked up more space on a Go plate, on a Go board than the opposition. But did it win?
Yeah.
I mean, did it even play?
Yes. Okay. That's, yeah.
Right. When I lose against my son in chess, do I lose? No, I don't. I'm in a part of a educational process with him so that eventually he can win for real. The same goes with the chess game that was, it was against Kasparov in the late 90s, where IBM Deep Blue won against Kasparov. It never played chess. It just processed algorithms. But yet we're talking about it as if it's winning.
Yes.
So the cop out is to say, of course, DeepMind won. But that's a, not just simplistic. It's also, I think, wrong in many ways.
Yeah.
Amazing, but not winning.
Yeah. I think actually for the listeners for this, what's a really good example of looking as what your whole book's about, we've now carried on a conversation based on you going to a local area, which is Union Square, to either watch people. And then we've opened it up. And that's the beauty of either a philosophical stance on observing or an anthropological. You can take that specific and make it into a kind of a whole other broader conversation around who we are, how we see. So it's yeah. One of the things you also talk about, I think it links in.
Actually, interrupt. You play jazz.
Yeah.
So I have an example in the you're a saxophone player. Yeah. I had this example. I asked some students to go and study being seen. What does it mean to be seen? And we thought, what's the place that's most stress-induced being seen environment? You know, you could say that's a school where the teacher can see you. But if you go to a jam session late at night in the Greenwich Village with amazing players, they just want to be seen by each other. And seeing the horror and the fear and the skill and the need to be seen involved in that, you can see sort of human drama playing out.
Yes,
you can enjoy the music, or if you're me, I'm more interested in seeing how are these people trying to be seen? How will you be seen? How do you get kicked out because you don't, you know, you're just off in some way or another? Like that human drama happens just down the street. And it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's a glorious thing.
I totally agree. And actually, the whole thing about being seen in that jam session, it's massively around social capital initiation. You know, we just roll on, right? It's all happening there, and potentially also beautiful music. But it's that kind of young blood coming through, and can they make that grade? You know, it's. So you talk about here in the book, The Looking Lab, and I know it kind of links in, but you've touched on Gestalt and the whole is, but what does The Looking Lab mean?
Well, that's what I called my old company, called Red Associates. It was my looking lab. It was kind of a laboratory for looking at humans in particular, to try to understand what on earth was going on and figuring out what to do about it. So for me, a looking lab is a group of people that have the practice of listening and looking at a very high level, and a sophisticated process to do that, which was the company I was part of building. So that's how I've thought about it. Other people say this is business anthropology or something like that. But to me, it's a looking lab. It's an experiment, philosophical experiment in what looking or seeing and listening even is.
Yeah, yeah. As a youngster, I was always engaged. By complete chance, we went on holiday in England to Suffolk by the sea, a famous town called Aldborough that's got an opera festival. And anyway, I used to go every morning. There was an old-style Victorian cinema, and I'd buy a chocolate bar and they had a series on this French guy I'd never heard of before. I was 14. I mean, Jacques Tati. And they showed my uncle. And I was sitting there by myself. I had no right to really engage with this critique of postmodernism or, you know. But what I've watched it many times since. And he was a kind of telling us what the looking lab was about. He was both making commentary, but seeing the difference, you know. That's what kind of resonated with me when I heard this term, read the term, the looking lab. Now, the other thing is that you're a professor at New School in New York, and for anyone who's listening, very much worth going to the website of New School, because it's part of Parsons, isn't it? Parsons does, and it's ready for, I think it's got something about it's pushing the boundaries of how education can be seen, which I really like. But you carry out something with your students called clean observation, and I'm just wondering, what does clean, is there a dirty observation? What is clean observation?
Right. Maybe it's not the best word. It came from a problem I had with students. So, and it was an increasing problem. So I taught the same class 10 years in a row. And what I found was every year the students would be more and more opinionated and be more and more skilled in having opinions. So they would have opinions about politics and religion and sports, you know, anything. They would have very quickly ready-made answers to anything in the world. And I think around 2016 or 2017, it started feeling unhealthy. Like it felt like they were no longer looking at anything. They were just built to have opinions that they pretty much taken over by professors and from things they heard from others rather than looking for themselves. So instead of doing that, we try to say, pick something simple, like a simple phenomenon. And instead of having opinions about it, just scrape off all the junk of opinions that you've taken over from others and have a look for yourself. So when you look at if you go to the coffee shop, you can have opinions about how the community is being taken over by hipsters, or you can have opinions about how coffee workers are being exploited, or you can have opinions that the prices are too high. You can have all kinds of opinions, but instead of that, wait for a second and just look at, what does having coffee even mean? Like, does it have to involve coffee? Not necessarily. What if it crosses into alcohol? Is it having coffee anymore? You know, when is having coffee flirtatious? When is it professional? You know, and so on. So start by looking at the idea or the phenomenon of having coffee without having opinions about it. So that's maybe clean is the wrong word, but it is trying to catch your own judgment and your own sort of, what is it called? Weak opinion, strongly held kind of attitude to the world, and just wait and describe what you see. And then suddenly you can see this sort of, you can see the world again, instead of through the sort of goggles of ready-made opinions.
Yeah, they're kind of given to you almost. You're supposed to consume exactly. The opinion rather than the observation.
Exactly.
So along with phenomenology, you bring in anthropology as well, which is, you know, fantastic. when as an anthropologist, there's something that I coined the phrase. It's called anthropological warfare, Christian. And what anthropological warfare is this complete fight between Britain and America about who actually started ethnography. All right, so, you know, I went to LSC, so Malinowski was, you know, seen as the bad, but America will say Franz Boas, and you've gone for the Boas, but was very, very interesting, who was an amazingly influential anthropologist. But where does anthropology then, why is that important for your book and your thinking around observing and looking?
Yeah. The chapter about anthropology was actually an article first that was called A Love Letter to Anthropology. And it was because at the moment, it was like, I mean, maybe 5 years ago or something, 3-4 years ago, there was a movement inside of anthropology called Anthropology Must Burn. And there are lots of articles about it, lots of sort of college campus demonstrations that anthropology was exploitative, you know, extracted things from people, which certainly has happened.
Yeah.
But saying the fundamental idea that humans can understand each other and the practice of trying to understand someone that's different from yourself is exploitative and wrong and therefore should stop, I think is maybe a step too far. I love the idea that we can at least try to understand someone that's not the same as yourself without being extractive. In that sense, so I just wanted to defend anthropology as a practice.
Yeah,
and it became then a chapter in the book because, of course, anthropology is the academic praxis of observation that is most advanced and so on.
No, I think yes, and you're ready. I mean, firstly, it doesn't feel like it's a separate area; it fits in. It totally complements. There is something very interesting. There's a very good book, and I'll put it on the thing, by Simon Cooper, a well-known anthropologist, who called Anthropology and Anthropologists. And it's a kind of history of anthropology, and it goes into the whole tension, complexity of the colonial process that anthropology was very fundamental in, and the idea of the exotic and exoticizing the other, and Edward Said. But there is something, though, if we can detach from the colonial past and look at what you're talking about, the everyday, which is going to Union Square and observing chess players. There is something about making the everyday special. And in a way, you are creating it into an exotic. And maybe to observe, there needs to be an ethical exotic, where it doesn't matter if I go and observe team dynamics in a hospital. That's an everyday interaction happening. But I will go in and see it as actually a complete special experience as a means of trying to then frame my observation. So I think that it's an interesting point. And then you also kind of talk about, I think you bring Bourdieu in and also Gillian Tett, the idea of the social silence. And I'm just, how does that kind of sit for you, the notion of social silence?
Yeah, well, it's Gillian's idea.
Yeah.
And it comes from Bourdieu. He calls it doxa.
Doxa.
So it's basically... that we the things we're not talking about but should be. So there are in her story, it's always as a journalist. She's a great journalist from the Financial Times, and she always looks for the things that are not being said. So at a conference, they're talking about a lot of stuff, and you can listen to that. But what are the things that they're not saying? And quite often that has to do with people. That you have any say financial environment. They would talk a lot about shares and options and futures and so on, but they wouldn't talk so much about people, which is why they can often be so awfully wrong. So the silence is what is it that these people are not saying? And an anthropologist or an observer have this this ability to not take what people say for granted, not just absorb it, as that's the way this works. Do that, but also say what are the things that are not in the equation here, and that's what I've done as an advisor over the years as well. Is just what are you not thinking about? What is it you're not talking about? And what is that so obviously real outside of a company or a government regulator And what you are not talking about is real inside. And sometimes you can see things that are quite helpful if you do that.
The book also, and again, for listeners, we don't have to go into this now, but it's also, there's a section in the book which looks at the lessons of almost how to observe. And, you know, just anyone who gets the book, as we all should, it's definitely worth having a look at that. Read the book first before you get to the lessons, I think. And it's almost a step-by-step, but it's set out in a way that there's no need for fear. It's actually doing it. Stepping out of the door, your front door every day, and thinking magic, I think, is the way that the lessons, that's what the conclusion is. I'm coming to the end, but there's one chapter that did step, and I want to tell you a story, maybe, and then because it relates to this chapter, and it's a story about birds. And when I was about 8 years old, I became a member in the UK of the Young Ornithologists Club. And my father used to take me bird watching, an hour and a half drive, maybe outside London, onto the South Downs near Brighton. But as a kid, I had a little book of garden birds, and there was one bird that just stood out. It was called the nuthatch. And the nuthatch is a very little bird it's kind of got a black stripe around its eye. And then we went on holiday to Wales, and my father was a great fly fisherman, and he would take me fly fishing, and he could see the trout in the stream. But I saw a nuthatch, and I'd never seen one in my life before, and I shouted, nuthatch, and my dad went crazy that I was making too much noise, and, you know. So about 3 weeks ago, I turned 52, and as my birthday present, I said, you know what I want? I want a freestanding bird feeder. I no longer bird, well, I mean, I'm left, you know, that can end it quite quickly, but I want to see if I can attract a nuthatch. So the bird feeder is outside my kitchen window, so I could be making a coffee and just watch the bird feeder, and they're blue tits and robins, and they all come and they all talk. But a nuthatch comes now every day.
Wow.
And I've only seen two before in my whole life, and I see one every single day. Now, I've watched it, and I see which it goes to the same trees before it flies down for the nuts, and the tits go at a different route. So I'm observing now, and this is when I read this. So it's come to this idea of you've got a chapter in the book based on a book by a bird watcher of peregrine falcons in England. And you, I'm going to, you know, you can shout me down if I'm wrong. You almost, or Red Associates, that your consultancy in Copenhagen, New York, almost kind of got a new lease of life because of this very thin book about watching a peregrine falcon in west of England. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, it sounds bananas, right?
Yeah. I'm buying the book, by the way. I've hunted it down.
Oh, it's my favorite book in the world. I read it every year.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. It's the best observation I've seen. Mm-hmm. The most skilled observer and also a poet. So just his prose is amazing. His name is J.A. Baker.
Yeah.
He wrote this book, and then he did some other notes, but primarily this book. And for many years, it's called The Peregrine. And for many years, we didn't know who he was. So it looks like he might have worked in a juice factory on the east side of London. But he spent most of his time watching the birds and the animals around him in Essex. Mm-hmm. And he then wrote this book where he follows a pair of peregrine falcons for 6 months. And it's day by day describing what he sees. And he starts from being, you could say, almost like a rational observer, where he's the subject and the animals are the objects, to almost merging with them and start saying, we fly or we stoop, instead of they stoop, and become sort of almost in a mystical way part of the place he's observing. And it has a series of learnings, I think. The article, I try to say, could you write about this book in a way that is almost like dumb Harvard Business Review press, kind of 10 steps to a better life kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for fun and as a joke, really. But the book is, if you want to learn about observation, that's the place to start, in my opinion. It describes how to do it and how to describe a phenomenon in such richness that, you know, you'd never be able to do it, but it's highly inspirational. And for me, I got that book from a colleague that just said, you should, this sounds like you, this sounds like something you'd enjoy. And it just, a bomb went off in my head when I read it the first time. And since then I've read it many, many times. That's taught it.
Oh, right. Like, so, yes. Is it part of the onboarding process now at Red Associates?
Yes. Here you go.
There you go. Read that. You don't need the laptop. Just read that and then you'll be...
Exactly. Exactly. And what happens to my students is I start by giving them that text. And they say, we came in here to study humans. Why on earth are you giving us that text? But then when the semester is over, they come back and said, we got it. We understand why you gave us this in the first place. And many people write afterwards. I mean, lots of kids have written me afterwards and said that was the most important part of it.
That's great. Christian, my final question I ask everyone, I'm going to now symbolically hand over to you through Zoom an anthropological or the anthropologist notebook. You can visualize it could be a moleskin or whatever. But where are you going to take this book to study for a year, somewhere for a year, and why?
Right. Well, the thing I, when you asked me the question, the thing I'm most interested in right now, it might not be the most joyous observation, but I would love to study the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia. I think I would be interested in figuring out how are they transforming a country? What are the thought processes for using capital, really lots of money, to transform a country from being one type that it was, let's say, 10 or 20 years ago, where you had lots of oppression and lots of misery, to this new modern place that they're dreaming up, where they hope to create a country that's more advanced than anything else.
Yeah,
I think that process of speeding up the process that let's say, you know, Denmark or the UK have been on for 200 years, see if they can compress that down to 20 years by the use of money. I mean, such an interesting experiment that might fail, but I don't know. I don't understand the intentions. I don't understand the vision.
Yeah.
I don't understand the proportions.
Yeah.
The amount the amount of buildings that's going to happen down there in the next 10 years is just mind-boggling. So the transformation of society through cash, I think would be fascascinating for me.
Maybe the deal should be it's not notebook, it's notebooks.
It would be probably.
I think you probably need it feels like you need notebooks for that one, and maybe longer than 12 months.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But that, yeah, I agree. That's a fascinating area. But
it's what happened. I mean, I was part of Samsung's rise. We worked for Samsung for 20 years. And seeing South Korea transform from being a quite local, slightly provincial place where very few people spoke English and you couldn't get pizza, and all the cars were made locally, to what it is today. That transformation over the course of 20 years is just astounding, what humans can do to their societies.
Yeah.
Well, also, this might be a window into it.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point. It's, I remember actually with Simon Roberts, we did some work on the introduction of broadband into the UK, but it was South Korea as the bastion of the example, where the focus was also on women in the house were going to be the owners of broadband, and they were the ones with it. It wasn't, so it challenged convention from day one as a means of creating technological innovation. So it's again seeing it, the whole, the Gestalt whole, I think, is really. Christian, thank you so much. We could have just, I think, carried on. Hopefully, just for the listeners, Christian and I have known each other for absolute years and have never spoken to each other apart from today. So this is going to be on my mind. and I'm going to be kind of running through. I'm going to carry on watching my bird feeder and thinking about that book. But thank you so much, Christian.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's lovely.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found my conversation with Christian insightful and that you have a deeper understanding of why looking, seeing and observing opens new ways of understanding the world around us. It costs nothing to look, but you must have the ability to push your boundaries and question why, what and what you are looking at and why this is important to you. I'll drop some links to the books that Christian referenced in the show notes. And finally, I realize I made a little mistake in the interview. I mentioned a book about anthropology by Simon Cooper. It is actually his father, Adam Cooper. Simon is an excellent features writer for the Financial Times and his father, an influential anthropologist. Episode 2 will be out next month, where I'll be talking about the history and the future of office design and work with Professor Jeremy Myerson, who heads up the Work Tech Academy and is Professor of Design at the Royal College of Art. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed and please give the podcast a rating on iTunes if you think it's any good, of course. And to keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link is also in the show notes, along with the link to make a small donation to the podcast. Bye for now.